Blasting in progress of this Ulster side. It's Bremer!
Welcome to Inside Ulster, the rugby podcast from the Bell Dale, with me, Niamh Campbell.
Me, Jonathan Bradley.
And me, Adam McKendrick. With expert analysis and special guests.
Let's kick off. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Bell Tales Inside Ulster Rugby Podcast. My name is Niamh Campbell, and I am joined this week by our sports reporter, Adam McKendry, who was ill last week, but thankfully is feeling better. But unfortunately, we don't know if he's passed on to Jonathan Bradley, who isn't here this week either. So if I'm not here next week, expect a pattern. There's a trend of sickness going on here.
Can I give a disclaimer? I have not seen Johnny since I was six, so it's definitely not me.
Well, there's something going around anyway. It's a bit like an over Ulster had that gastroenteritis bout. But yes, hopefully Johnny O is feeling better and we'll be back next week. But until then, you have us, of course, and we're going to be answering some listener questions again today, but also discussing the chaos. Any headlines that I've seen about the Scotland-Ireland match on Sunday is just has the word chaos or chaotic in it, which I think is a really good way to sum it up. Adam, what do you think?
Yeah, rightly so. Like, it just was chaos between injuries and tries and, oh my goodness, it was another Six Nations game. I think I said after the France game that you will not get a better test game than that. This one actually came pretty close, and I think we probably expected it to be a good game given how Scotland have been going recently, but that was something else. Like, the first half was almost on a par with the Ireland-France game. I would still say the Ireland-France game was better, but I would say this one was, in terms of the handling and the kinds of plays that both teams were trying to pull off, I think that was pretty close. And then just the injuries taking over, you know, with Josh van der Fleer throwing into lineouts and Cian Healy coming on at hooker, and you were having all sorts of funky combinations. And then
describe it.
Yeah, funky combinations.
Still works.
I mean, yeah, you know, is the old cliche, if it looks stupid but it works, is it stupid? I mean, Cian Healy might be getting a call up in the two jersey this week. I think the thing that you have to take from it, and the sort of overriding feeling after the game, was that the best teams in the world, whenever they've got their backs up against the wall, find ways to win. Ireland, while they didn't necessarily have their backs up against the wall necessarily by what Scotland were doing, they were forced into a really uncomfortable position by all the injuries, and they were playing a good Scotland team that could have caused them a lot more problems in the second half if they had continued what they were doing in the first half. And they came through. You know, they dug really deep in order to get this win. And that, to me, is what I think Andy Farrell will be taking away from this most of all, which is that even whenever his team are struggling in terms of, you know, everything seems to be going against them, having to make so many changes in the first half, Scotland really putting the fight up to them, they still find a way to win. And that's the hallmark of a winning team. And I know he said after the game, it's bizarre that he said this whenever you consider some of the wins that Ireland have had, like that game against France, winning the first ever test series in New Zealand. And he says, that one's probably the biggest win of my career. That shows you just how much his team had to fight for this win. And in the end, it was comfortable. You know, they win by 15 points, if I've done my maths right. They win by 15 points. Like, that's nothing to be sniffed at against a Scotland team who have won in England, have rightly been touted as possibly the best Scotland team of the professional era, which I would agree with. I would think that's probably that probably does rank up there with some of his best wins. Personally, I wouldn't put it above the New Zealand or the France game, but I can understand why he would say what he did.
Mm-hmm. And just for anyone that didn't actually know just the severity of Ireland's injuries, Dan Sheehan, Keelan Doris and Ian Henderson had all departed by the 24th minute of the game. Replacement hooker Ronan Kelleher was clearly, he was basically going with one arm at the end of it all, before he eventually conceded defeat and realised he had to come off as well. Mm. And he came off after 48 minutes. And there were five injuries in total. Do you think, Adam, one thing as well, you know, we were talking about, it really speaks to the depth of the team and the fact that they obviously have a plan B. And Andy Farrell said that when they went in at half time, the players all just laughed, you know, at the sheer chaos of it, which I think that's a really good position to be in. You're just like, this is absolute mental. Like, everyone's getting hurt all over the place. You know, do you think this Ireland team we're seeing, is it, what do you think it is compared to other teams in the past? Because obviously we have the World Cup coming up as well, and they've fallen at that hurdle so many times before. Do you think it's just the depth of the squad? Do you think it's just they're all so cohesively playing together, and they do just have this plan B? Or what do you think it is?
I think it's a little bit of a combination of everything. I mean, the fact that they're all so relaxed that they can go in and have a laugh about how absurd the situation is. Oh, like, absolutely. Like, I would be exactly the same. I don't know how you could possibly go in after that first half knowing that you're down three substitutes already. Like, in the test sphere, that's such a massive thing. In some club rugby games, you can get away with that because of the disparity between the teams. Whenever you're playing in a Six Nations game with a Grand Slam on the line, if you're going in at halftime knowing you're down three game-changing substitutes for the second half, you're down three very key players as well for the start. And you're going in and everyone's laughing about the absurdity of the situation. That says a lot about a dressing room that is both relaxed but also confident in their ability to come through that. You know, I think if there's any sort of nerves or fear from that Ireland team and they go in at half time and they're all sitting there heads down, morose, like, Ireland were a point up, but everything seemed to be going against them on the scoreboard. Like, don't forget, if Hugo Keenan hadn't made a very crucial try-saving tackle on Dujan van der Merwe towards the end of that half, Ireland are going in, based on where van der Merwe probably would have scored that try, they're probably 15-7 down. Or sorry, 15-8, sorry. And, sorry, no, 14-8 down. Let me get that right. My maths is all over the place today. So you're suddenly down on the scoreboard. You're going in that position. So for me, the fact that they're looking at that and being able to sort of see the lighter side of it, this is a side that is comfortable with each other. They're a side that are confident in their own ability, and that all bodes well for the World Cup. I think in the past, what we have seen from Ireland teams is that whenever we get to the World Cup, they start to really become very internalized. You know, they start to realize the magnitude of the situation. They start to think, well, it's a World Cup year. We've got to start getting this right. We've got to start getting that right. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. And then once you get to the World Cup, you're so wound up that everything sort of releases at once and it all backfires on you, because Ireland are always good enough that they should always be making the knockouts. But then once they get to the knockouts, it's like, we don't know what to do with ourselves. And the pressure comes on because,
never,
you know,
got this far.
Yeah, we've never made it to the semifinals. We've got to get over the line here. And then they crumble under the pressure. This Ireland team is relaxed. This Ireland team is playing well. And the difference between Ireland teams in the past is they are playing in dominant fashion. It's not like they are squeaking results. It's not like they're just sort of, you know, they're not losing games, obviously. So whenever you've got that depth that you're able to bring on guys, whenever you've got a prop who can come on at hooker and do an admirable job, I think it also helps. You know, if Ireland had gotten down to 14 men, I'm not sure how they would have manage the rest of the game. I'm not sure how much it would have changed it. I still think they probably could have won, but Cian Healy coming on doing that job just made everything so much more comfortable, and having Andrew Porter go the 80 really helped too. So I think you're looking at an Ireland team that are just, they're just in the right headspace. And I think I'm not going to sort of jump the gun here and say that that means they're perfectly placed going into the World Cup. There's a lot of time between now and the World Cup for things to potentially go wrong. You know, Ireland are still in a position where if Jonathan Sexton gets injured, they're in serious trouble. They're still in a position where if Tadhg Furlong gets injured, they're not in as much trouble as they were before, because we've seen the rise of Finlay Balaam and Tom O'Toole stepping up as well. But it still puts them in a little bit of a bind in the biggest games. So I think it's more just they're going about things in the right way at the moment. It's about trying to make sure they keep doing that and keep, you know, they've learned how to face adversity well.
Yeah.
They need to find a way to sort of amplify that, because in a World Cup, you are going to face adversity, that you have a smaller squad. You don't have guys you can just fly in at a moment's notice. So I would say this is probably a good sign. They just need to make sure that they know how to use that properly whenever it comes to the crunch time in the World Cup, which is, of course, what we're all sort of building towards.
Gearing towards. And we've got lots, obviously, before then too, because we can't forget about this coming weekend. We're recording this in Tuesday, of course, but Ireland will be without Gary Ringrose and Ian Henderson for the final leg of their Grand Slam bid against England this weekend. Andy Farrell has called up Leinster lock Ross Maloney and Ulster hooker Tom Stewart as cover ahead of the England game. One stat, I love a good stat in this podcast, not since 2003 have Ireland had a chance to win a Grand Slam on home soil, something they've only managed once in 1948 when Jack Kyle and his team made history at Ravenhill. So they've the chance to make history in Dublin on Saturday, Adam. They're going up against it. Before we started recording, I was talking to Adam and I literally described England's performance against France as just super bad, which was a really, really good use of the English language there. And Adam was like, please just say that in the podcast, because that is the only way to describe it. I saw a headline as well in one of the Sunday papers that they were kind of harsh, but they were embarrassed, Adam. England were embarrassed by France at the weekend.
Yeah, like the long and short of it was that was awful.
Yeah.
You know, no team wants to lose on home soil. To lose that convincingly, and again, if I do my maths right, I think it was 43 points, sorry. You know, a 43-point shellacking on home soil against, all right, they're a great France side. They are going to reigning champs, one of the favourites for the World Cup, but good grief, shipping 53 points at home.
I don't think anyone expected it.
I think it's almost made worse by the fact that England have made all these changes. You know, they've brought Steve Borthwick in, they've axed Eddie Jones, brought Borthwick in, and the whole point is trying to change things around quickly. You know, they've got that longer term goal in view of they want Borthwick to be the guy to lead them forward beyond 2023, probably into 2027. I don't know how long his contract is, but I would imagine whenever they appointed him, they're thinking that he's actually the man for 27. If he can turn around for 2023, great, but he's probably the man to turn around for 2027. But you were hoping that England would have sort of this new coach boost, mm-hmm. that whenever they came into the Six Nations, that guys would be happier in training. We heard all the talk about Eddie Jones by the end, you know, the players hated his training. They detested it. They really, every time they came off the training pitch, they were so happy that they were dumb.
I bet you he's buzzing now.
but this is the thing, like they thought, you know, Borthwick coming in would be that spur of, okay, we can improve. And then they had that damp squib against Scotland where they just weren't good. So they get back on the horse, you know, they beat Italy, they beat Wales, you know, but those are your two easiest games. And it was almost that false dawn, and then you hit France and France just put on an absolute masterclass against them. So, you know, he hasn't settled on a fly half yet, which I know he's still getting used to the squad. Like, he hasn't worked with a lot of these players before. So I think it's tough for him to sort of chop and change on the fly, especially in a competition where the standard is so high as the Six Nations. It's not like you're taking a squad of 50 away on a tour to Argentina or something like that, and or the Autumn Nations, and you're able to take a look at a few guys. This is the Six Nations where you really are going to be judged more than in any other competition apart from the World Cup. And he's just got to be given time to bed in. You know, I don't think this is necessarily a Steve Borthwick's fault kind of thing. This is just England rugby has gotten itself into a bad situation where they've made a change just short of the World Cup, hoping that things will change, and it has backfired on them.
Mm-hmm.
Long term, I think Steve Borthwick could still be the man for England.
Transitional phase, just.
Yeah, the problem is they've just got to give him time. And the issue is, as everything is in this year, everything is framed around the World Cup. So everyone's looking at this and going, well, England are in a disastrous place at the moment,
mm-hmm.
because they're losing games by 43 points at home. They're going into a World Cup with a crisis of confidence. This is absolutely disastrous. If this happened next year, I don't think the outcry is quite so big, because people will say, new coach, we're retooling, you know, we have the longer term view at hand. It's solely because this is 2023 and there is a World Cup at hand that everyone's suddenly going, this is absolutely disastrous because we're not going to win the World Cup. If you took the World Cup out of this year, I think people are sort of thinking, give him time to work his magic with this squad. It's kind of like, and I always sort of try and stay away from using like American comparisons, but in American sport, a lot of teams will go through like rebuilding phases mm-hmm. whenever they've sort of had that period of success, and then they sort of hit the salary cap and they have to offload a load of their best players because they can't afford them anymore. So, you know, this is kind of the same for England, where you've got a new coach in, you've got to just let him bed in. You've got a team that were struggling under Eddie Jones. He's got to be allowed the opportunity to rebuild their confidence. And look, I'm not saying that England aren't contenders for the World Cup, because they could turn this around, but on this form right now, they are a team that just need anything to get them back on track, because that kind of result is one that's very hard mentally to bounce back from.
Well, that's sort of what I was going to say to you next, because Johnny Sexton and Andy Farrell said, as they do all the right media trained things, you know, when asked about obviously this weekend coming, they basically said that England could be like a team possessed after losing so emphatically, and you know they're not to be taken lightly because of that. But do you reckon this weekend's a done deal? We're going to see our good our historic Grand Slam.
I mean, look, there will be a response from England. Like you can't have a result like that and not have any response. So I'm not saying that England are going to come in, they're going to be absolutely devastated, they're going to roll over like that. If you are an England player who's involved in that game on Saturday and you aren't feeling absolutely devastated going into training this week, if you're not motivated to turn that around this week, then I don't think they're going to last very long in the squad. So I think we will see a response from England. I don't think it will be a big enough response to beat Ireland. I think Ireland are a team who are just riding a wave of confidence. They are quite rightly the best team in the world because they have the depth and the quality in that squad that is probably better than any other nation. I would say probably the France, like if you compare first 15s between Ireland and France, they're probably very similar. But I would say Ireland have the depth that France don't necessarily have. They have it, but it's not as good as Ireland's. I think Ireland are just far too good for England at the moment, and that's I don't even really want to add more to that. It's a podcast, so I will, but you know, Ireland are just too good for England right now. England are a team who are still trying to work out who they are under Steve Borthwick. And although they do have some extremely talented players in that squad, the cohesiveness is not there. And Ireland, I think, will... I'm not going to say they're going to... And the thing is, like, Ireland are shorn short of enough players that I think they're going to have that little bit of a come down in terms of performance, just naturally whenever you lose guys like Ringrose and Henderson. Mm-hmm. So I would say it would still be comfortable. I would say that Ireland are going to have this one pretty early. I would say by the time you sort of hit the 70 minute mark, I think they'll be starting to etch that name on the trophy.
Well, England have lost their centre, Ollie Lawrence, for the final game of their somewhat miserable campaign. And as I said, Ringrose and Henderson are out. And it looks like Henderson, so he's going to undergo surgery on a fractured forearm. And he's also set to miss Ulster's Heineken Champions Cup clash with Leinster on April 1st, as well as Saturday's game. Just talk a wee bit about Ulster, as we are inside Ulster, Adam. How big, I know we're looking far off into the future now, next month, but how big of a miss is that? I mean, we've been talking about Hendy. He's basically the best, most high-profile player in Ulster. Well, we've been on a bit of a winning streak lately after a very, what seems like a forever period of bad runs.
Yeah, remember that Christmas period where we were all doom and gloom? And
we've come so far. The sun's starting to show.
Ireland are going for a Grand Slam. Ulster starting to look like a team who could maybe mount a silverware challenge. It's all good now, you know. I don't know what you're saying about the sun, though. It was snowing whenever I left my house this morning.
Metaphorically, the sun's come out for Ulster.
Obviously a massive blow. But I think, and we had a lot of listener questions about Henderson, and rightly so, given that it does seem like every time he goes away with Ireland, he gets injured, and Ulster are the ones who suffer more than Ireland do. Ireland can cover his absence. He's obviously a massive blow to Ireland, but as we were saying there, Ireland have the depth that Ulster don't to cover a loss like Henderson. Whereas for Ulster, you're losing your captain, the heartbeat of your pack, one of your consistent go-forward ball carriers. The only saving grace I think you have from an Ulster perspective is Ulster know how to play without him. Like, they are used to not having Henderson for long stretches of the season. So it's not like they've lost somebody who has played in every game this season and all of a sudden you're having to bring someone else in to fill a gap. Ulster have very well-established second row partnerships in there that they can turn to, you know, like O'Connor and Carter, O'Connor and Treadwell, Treadwell and Carter. As a Chukwu who's come back into the squad in recent weeks, you've had Harry Sheridan playing in the second row, which is a little bit of a left field selection, but he's been playing so well that you maybe decide to put him in the second row instead of in the back row. You even had Henderson playing back row for Ulster before he went away with Ireland. So there's a lot of combinations there that Ulster can turn to, but like bottom line, he's a massive loss for Ulster, especially for that European game against Leinster. You know, that's the one where you need your big players to be involved, and to lose him is a pretty big blow. Like, it's not terminal. You know, Ulster are bigger than just one player. Their hopes and dreams don't lie solely on the availability of Ian Henderson, but certainly you've lost a significant ball carrier in that pack, and for an Ulster team who don't have a lot of guys who can punch hole in defences, if you lose someone like that against a defence as watertight as Leinster's, you're naturally going to have a bit of a tougher time. So it'll be interesting to see maybe not how they fill that gap, but who they use to fill that gap. Because I would imagine O'Connor is pretty nailed on as one of those second row players. He's been so consistent, and Dan McFarlane loves to go back to him all the time. But do you go with Carter, who is much more tactically savvy, as in, you know, he's a much better line-out option than Kieran Treadwell, he's quite good in the maul, or do you go with the guy who would be the better ball carrier, which would be Treadwell, but maybe someone who is not quite so dangerous at the set piece? That's probably something that we'll discuss, you know, in the lead up to the game next month, but it's already a very interesting decision. And the thing is, though, you know, Ian Henderson is a remarkable recoverer. We always say, you know, if you say he's going to be out for 6 weeks, he'll be playing next week or something like that. Yeah. So they say he's out for the European game. I suspect he will be, but never say never.
Exactly. And maybe that's a question that we can ask the listeners now if they want to tweet us at InsidePulseUlsterBT, who they think or who they think should replace Hendy for that game if it comes to that. But in terms of, yeah, like you said, Adam, I was building up a wee bit to the listener questions, and Big Jim, you've answered quite a lot of it there, to be fair. But Big Jim said Hendy plays for Ireland, gets injured, gets rehab just in time for the next set of Ireland matches and misses Ulster's games. Repeat, discuss. And then Neil, apologies, Neil, if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, it's preferred or furred. Neil replied to Big Jim and said, the real question for me is it disruptive to the rest of the team, including the leadership group, to have this pattern repeatedly with the club captain who is very seldom available for Ulster? And I guess just on top of everything you've already answered, Adam, obviously you're a sports reporter and rugby analyst, but as an Ulster fan, obviously the fans that are asking us these questions are quite annoyed by this. Is it annoying to you? Is it something that you think that in terms of the Ireland setup and being in cohesion, I guess, with the Ulster setup, do you think, are they just not, is it the physios, are they just not managing his injuries well? Or what do you, like, is it annoying for you as a fan?
As a fan, like, obviously it's annoying. Like, I get where all these questions are coming from, because you want your best players playing for Ulster. You want your best players to be available. Like, if you're buying a ticket to an Ulster game, with the greatest of respect to, you know, the academy guys and the guys who are maybe further down the depth charts, you're not going to watch them. You're going because you want to watch Ian Henderson, you want to watch Dwayne Vermeulen, you want to watch Mike Lowry and John Cooney, Stuart McCloskey. That's why you buy your ticket. And it's the same whenever other teams come. You know, whenever Leinster come and play at Ravenhill, you want them to have Jonathan Sexton in the squad. You want them to have Gary Ringrose playing and Caelan Doris. And I could go through the entire Leinster team. You just want to see all of them involved. So from a fan's perspective, of course, you know, Henderson not being available directly affects how well Ulster are going to play. Ulster are a better team when Ian Henderson is available. They are more likely to win games and win silverware whenever Ian Henderson is available. And there is obviously a frustration that he plays for Ireland, he gets injured, he misses Ulster games, he comes back for maybe one Ulster game, and then he's away with Ireland again. Of course, that's
Ireland
frustrating.
Ireland get the majority of him exactly. before he's injured.
Exactly. Look, I have no doubt that it's a frustration to Dan McFarland as well and his teammates as well. You know, whenever you are a coach of a team, you want your players to be available. You know, nobody's sitting here and saying this is a good situation. Ulster aren't sitting there and saying that. The fans aren't saying that. Ireland aren't saying that. Henderson himself isn't saying that. It's a bad situation for everyone. I understand why Ulster fans feel like they're the ones getting hurt the most, and I suppose to a degree, yes, they are the ones getting hurt the most, but at the end of the day, Ireland reign, you know, the Irish system stands with the IRFU at the top, and what suits them is what goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Ireland want Henderson rested for a game, he will be rested for a game under the player management program. If Ireland want him to be called up to the Six Nations squad, he will be called up to the Six Nations squad because they pay his salary. He's on a central contract. You know, he is an employee of the IRFU first and foremost before he is an employee of Ulster.
Mm.
So it as far as the injuries go, it's just bad luck. You know, it's not like he goes away and deliberately gets injured so that he misses Ulster games and then comes back for Ireland.
Yeah. He's thrown himself into it with everything he has, I think, and then that's why, because he's just brave, and that's why he gets injured, arguably. So, yeah.
It's the style of game he plays. You know, he's an abrasive player who puts himself in harm's way.
He put his head where you wouldn't put a spade, as we say in the Lowcountry.
As the proper country sound. So look, I understand the frustrations, and it would be a completely different situation, I think, if Henderson was saying, I'm only going to play for Ireland. You know, I am deciding to play one game for Ulster and then go away with Ireland. That would be a different situation. That's a very extreme example. But you can't blame the guy for getting injured. You know, he's just as likely to get injured for Ulster as he is for Ireland. And he has gotten injured for Ulster in the past. You know, people always look at him getting injured for Ireland and go, well, this is terrible that he's injured and he misses all these Ulster games. Well, he's gotten injured for Ulster too.
Yes,
and there's no outcry whenever he gets injured for Ulster because, like, well, he was playing for Ulster anyway. You know, there's every chance that Henderson comes back, plays one game for Ulster, and gets injured and misses 10 weeks. You know, it's you can't predict injuries, or you can't do that. He is just, I mean, you do have to say he is naturally a player who gets injured a lot. You know, like, you've got to look at that injury profile, and you can't deny that he is a player who picks up his fair share of injuries. And that, again, that's just down to the nature of the role that he plays and how he plays the game. But you can't look at it and go, this is Ireland's fault for him getting injured, or it's unfair on Ulster for him getting injured while playing for Ireland. That's just the way of the game.
It is frustrating, but keeping on the Hendy theme, Donal has asked, is Hendy the new Will Addison? And speaking of, where is Will Addison in his rehab and contract? Do we know, Adam?
Ulster like to keep things very quiet in terms of injuries, so we know that he's been trying to make comebacks over the course of the season, and it just hasn't worked out. And the thing is, it's a really tough one in terms of the contract situation, because as much as he is an amazing player, and I think the longer he's out, the more you forget just how good of a rugby player Will Addison is. Like, he probably gets back into the Ireland squad if it is not for the fact that he is injured. So for Ulster, you've still got to look at it from a business perspective of, are we getting value for money here? And that's why Addison's such a difficult situation, because he is an amazing player when fit, but he's so rarely fit. And you've got to weigh up the pros and cons of, do we keep this guy in the hope that he comes back and we have this quality player at our disposal again? Or do we say, we can't afford to keep a guy who's constantly injured on our books? And, like, you know, it's so easy. Like, I'd love to be able to say, yeah, keep him. You know, he's going to come back and he's going to be great. And if he does get back to full fitness and he has a run of games, like, that's the thing. We've now, apart from his first season in Ulster, we have not seen Will Addison have a continual run of games to show how good he is on a consistent basis.
Yeah. It's reward versus risk, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you said to me right now that Will Addison is back for the start of next season, fully fit, round to go, I say put a contract in front of him right now. But the issue is, and look, the Ulster medical team will know this. The Ulster medical team will be looking at him and going, We think you will be back for the start of next season. We think, well, you'll be back next week or something. And Ulster will make their decision off the back of that. The problem is the injuries have been so prolonged that when do you make the decision to either give him the contract or cut ties?
We don't know in terms, like, they haven't actually come forward and said forthright what they're doing in terms of that, Ulster.
No, they haven't, and we're getting to a position, like, we're in March now, where I would say Ulster have done all of their business. They just haven't announced it. Like, if you're a player who is not Welsh and is still waiting on a contract right now, chances are there's maybe not going to be a massive amount out there for you. I would take a very educated guess and say that Ulster have done 99% of their business. There are maybe a couple of players who are still in that sort of will they, won't they. And Will Addison might be one of them, purely based on the injury profile. But I would say there's a good chance that Ulster know what's happening with Will next season. And it's such a tough one. You know, he's such a good player, and if there were no doubts over his injury profile, he'd be one of the first players being re-signed every single season. It's just the injury profile that makes him such an unknown.
When we hear any sort of whispers, we'll let all the listeners know, of course. And Stephen McCormick has also asked here, would you agree, Adam, that Stuart Muir is the standout back of our season so far, yet would he be selected in our best fully fit 15, whether at centre or fullback?
He's certainly been impressive recently. I'll say that much. I would say Stuart McCloskey's still the standout back.
Like, I said last week, we missed you in the Stuart McCloskey fan club.
I still edited the podcast last week, so I heard the lack of Stuart McCloskey loving. Stuart McCloskey is still Ulster's standout back. Stuart Muir has probably been number two. I would agree with that. And whenever a player is playing so well, I think you do sort of have to start looking at, okay, where do we fit this guy in? You know, he's played on the wing, he's played fullback, he's played centre. I still think centre is his best position and will be where he sort of settles long term. The problem is you still have so many guys in that back line who were so good last year. And the question is, how long do you stick with them and sort of try and get them back into form? You know, James Hume last season at times was unplayable. And I think he showed glimpses of that in the win over Cardiff. So is that a sign that he's on his way back to form? I think Mike Lowry has really had a tough season, but he's also had a couple of injuries that have just held him back a wee bit. But we all know how good he is at breaking defences and running from deep. How long do you persist with him? Do you even consider putting him on the wing, where nobody's really put their hand up? You know, Stockdale had a good game against Cardiff, but he hasn't really sparked into life as Ulster and Ireland would have hoped. Balakoon's constantly injured this season. Guys like McIlroy and Moxham and Little, they're all solid, but none of them have really sort of stepped up a la Harry Sheridan in the back row and really made that jersey their own. So do you maybe consider putting him back on the wing alongside Stockdale? There are options there. Like, if you were asking me what back line I would select for the Leinster game, which I assume is sort of where this question is kind of coming from, mm-hmm. you know, like what... If you're selecting your best back line, which is what Ulster will do for that Leinster game, where would Murr factor in? Personally, I think I would have him in there somewhere. Maybe fullback. I don't know. After that Cardiff game, I'm not so sure anymore, because I think you want to persist with Hume, and you've obviously got McCluskey to come back in. He's obviously going straight in at centre. So do you put Hume with McCluskey, whose partnership we all know is dynamite from last season? Like, it might just be that there's right now there's not a position for him, and it's a tough one because he has been playing so well. But I think Ulster are very wedded to trying to get this back line playing like they were last season.
Mm-hmm. And then it'll be interesting to see what actually does happen for this Leinster game in terms of our post-match analysis in the far future. But Sam Lennon has asked, should Luke Marshall start at 13 against Leinster? He's been great this season when he has played.
I mean, again, yeah, Luke Marshall has been very good. Again, he's had his injury issues, so he's sort of been in and out of the squad. Personally, I think he's missed too much time to jump him back above Murr and Hume. And again, I think they are married to trying to get this back line, you know, from last season clicking again this season. So I would say no, he does not start against Leinster. I could certainly see him being named on the bench, but I don't think he's a starter.
Yeah, pretty short and to the point there, Adam. Good man.
I did want to clarify this. I love Luke Marshall.
I'm only joking.
Like, I love Luke Marshall. He's such a good guy anytime he's talking to us. And he has had a really good season. Problem is, centre is just a position with so much depth.
So competitive at the minute. Donald's also asked here, Andy Farrell, we've actually talked a wee bit about this in the podcast before. Andy Farrell said last year that the biggest area for the team to make gains was in the mental side of the game, an area often spoken about as a vulnerability of Ulster in closing games out. Given the speed of improvement in Ireland's mental skills in relatively short time spent together, have Ulster got the right person leading this area in their backroom team? You'd imagine more contact with the players would yield faster results. All about our psychological side of things.
All about our psychological side.
We love pretending we're like shrinks in this podcast every week. Sports psychology.
I'm just going to get the question up in front of me again just so I can sort of have it in front of me and sort of address the point.
Yeah, it's lengthy. It's a good question though. That's why we talk about it. try to ponder ourselves all the time.
Exactly. If you'd asked me this question a couple of months ago, I would have said that Ulster's mental game was the weakest part of their game.
Mm-hmm.
Because they went on that run of results, obviously around Christmas, December, start of January, and they just couldn't get themselves out of it. And the best teams are able to find ways out of a bind. Like, Ireland weren't necessarily in a bind at Murrayfield, but they found their way through adversity. Ulster got themselves behind the eight ball and then fell further and further behind it with every passing week because they just couldn't find a way to break themselves out of that rut. Even whenever they got a win against Connacht, they still got themselves stuck in the rut. They just couldn't get themselves out of it. So if you'd asked me back then, I would have said that this is probably the weakest part of their game. But since then, I think they've actually showed a remarkable resiliency, because whenever it came down to it, they didn't have to win the Connacht game. You know, it was only preferable that they did, but losing that Connacht game wouldn't have torpedoed their season. Losing to Sale would have been an utterly disastrous result and probably would have had severe ramifications if they had lost. But backs against the wall, they managed to pull that result out. And off the back of that, they didn't have the perfect performance against the Stormers, but they won that game. They came back and had a pretty poor game against Glasgow, but they responded to that with a big win against the Sharks. And then they did the business against Cardiff. So I would say that honestly, they've probably improved over the course of 2 months. I think whatever they have found over the last 2 months, and it's very interesting, we need to sort of ask them more about it and sort of say, you know, what have you actually done to sort of change around the mood in this team? I think that they have managed to turn a corner. Now, that does not necessarily mean that they are now mentally strong. It might just mean that they've managed to find a couple of results and pull them out of the fire, which teams sometimes do. But we know that Ulster have invested in the mental side of the game. They've got the sports psychologist in. There's a lot more talking about, you know, how they approach games as opposed to just, you know, nutrition and
strength and conditioning
and all that. It is now more about, you know, psychologically, how are we prepared for this game? And psychologically, what are we doing?
It takes time, though. I think that's the big thing. It does take time.
And look, the only thing I'll say, though, is that Ulster have had time. Like, this isn't a team that has been put together at the start of this season. This is a squad that is, for the most part, unchanged from last season. So they have been working through all this together for a couple of years. I would say the mental side of the game, it still is not the strongest part of the game, but they are working on it. And I think we have seen a lot of resiliency from this team over the last couple of months, which definitely factors in under the mental strength. I think they'll be tested a lot more towards the end of the season. And I think this is probably the time where you discover how much they've learned from previous disappointments. You know, we've had a lot of games where in the past Ulster have crumbled under the pressure in knockout games. How well have they learned from that and taken it forward? They always say, we're going to learn from this. You know, every single season, we almost get sick of it. You know, Ulster saying, we're going to learn from this. We're going to take this into next season. We're going to use this hurt. We are yet to see Ulster actually do that. So let's see how they cope with it in the final parts of the season.
100%. Last question, because we're running out of time. So we'll get another one in from SKM Martin here, who has said, and Johnny actually touched on this in his column this week. If you want to ask him or anyone else, want to go on belfasttelegraph.co.uk to read that. So he has said, with Ulster clubs performing well in the All-Ireland League, for example, Ballinahinch avoiding a relegation battle in Division 1A, Armagh top of Division 1B, Queen's top of Division 2A, and Instonians, runaway winners of Division 2C. Is this improved performance relevant or important to the Ulster senior side's future development, Adam?
Well, certainly I think one of the things that Ulster have suffered from is not having a team in 1A, and Ballinahinch being up in 1A and starting to perform so well, I think only bodes well, because it's somewhere that guys can go and get good quality club rugby. You know, you're coming up against a lot of Leinster Academy guys and Munster Academy guys whenever you get to 1A. So if you're having guys like Cormac Azuchukwu and Marcus Ray and Matty Ray, whether you think they should be in the senior squad or not, but if you have those guys going down and routinely every week playing at this relatively high level as opposed to maybe 1B or 2A, it can only help keeping them sharp for whenever they do come back up to the senior squad, that they won't be a million miles off the pace. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a big gulf between club rugby and senior rugby. You know, you're going from professional to semi-professional. Mm-hmm. There is a massive level drop. But the more quality opposition you play, the better prepared you will be for whenever you do make that step up. So I think it is very good for certainly a club game in Ulster. And look, just the perception of club rugby in Ulster, you know, the better the teams are playing, the more column inches they're going to get, the more, the better feeling there is going to be around the club. And, you know, Estonians, I think, are doing marvellous work down in 2C, and they're going to be up in 2B next season. And what they've done there just to turn everything around and to come back up into the senior All-Ireland setup, and they're now sort of working their way up is superb. And I know Johnny had a great interview with Clem Boyd, who runs things down there, just talking about what they've done and how they've improved. So I'd highly recommend everyone to sort of check that out. And, you know, just plain and simple, you know, the better that the Ulster clubs do, the more or the better feeling there will be around the province, and the more that feeds into the senior team, the more options that Ulster have to send their players down to get quality rugby, the better, so that, you know, you're sort of dispersing the talent a bit.
The other thing too is like when it's like a vicious cycle, but a good cycle. If more teams are doing better, it's like a good advertisement for younger people coming up, like, oh, maybe I will join rugby and try to play for them, try to play for my local team. And reputation can be a good advertisement for participation and attendance as well.
Jonathan's column today, I think, is a very important point, which is that whenever players finish at school level, how many actually keep playing? And I'll not spoil it too much, because, again, people should go and read it. Whenever players finish up with schools rugby, how many actually go on and keep playing rugby if they don't make it into the Ulster senior setup? And that should be a real breeding ground for players at club rugby level.
Mm-hmm.
You should have a lot of guys coming out of school and going, well, all right, it's disappointing that my school's career is over. Where can I go now to play my club rugby? Oh, there's a club up the road. Let's go and play for them. You know, you've got so many Belfast schools who are dominant in the Schools Cup. We've seen the number of all Belfast finals over the last few years. Where are all those players going whenever they finish up Schools Rugby? Okay, not all of those players are going to make it as a professional, but there are a lot of quality players who then decide, well, I'm just going to hang up the boots. That's me done now that I don't have any professional aspirations. So yeah, so we've got all these Belfast schools dominating the Schools Cup, and the highest ranked Belfast club in the All-Ireland League are Malone, who are bottom of Division 1B. You know, if you had a lot more players coming from those schools and deciding we're going to go to, and I'm not saying just Malone, you know, you've got Belfast Harlequins as well, and plenty of other places to go. Looking further afield, you've always got Ballymena, Banbridge, plenty of places, and City of Armagh, as we're saying. If you have players dispersing out, the Belfast schools should be naturally the ones that benefit the most. Or sorry, the Belfast clubs should be the ones that naturally benefit the most, and yet you don't have one even pushing remotely close to Division 1A at the moment. So there is more to be done to sort of increase participation in the club game, but it's great to see, you know, Ballinahitch pushing towards the playoffs. Queens are leading Division 2A. City of Armagh leading Division 1B. Estonians coming up. There are good things happening. There is more to be done, though.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Well, also, me and Johnny had, whenever you were sick, Adam, we had touched a lot about the Schools Cup final last week, and that is, of course, everyone's so caught up with England and Ireland. But yes, Danske Bank Schools Cup final is on this Friday, St. Patrick's Day, kicking off from Ravenhill at 3 p.m, and it's Campbell College versus Inst. So we'll be talking about that next week as well. Hopefully we would have fit it in with all this Grand Slam, hopefully Grand Slam historic madness on top of that. But for now, we're going to love you and leave you. If anyone does want to read Johnny's column about the school's rugby that we were just talking about there. It was posted on the 13th of March, because we're recording this on Tuesday, the 14th of March. Posted online on March 13th, if anyone wants to go back on belfasttelegraph.co.uk to read that. And of course, you can go on the website during all the rest of this week to catch up with Adam and Johnny and everyone's rugby news, views and analysis ahead of the weekend. And of course, after the weekend too, or you can just be old school and pick up a Belfast Telegraph newspaper. But until next week, well, hopefully we're going to be talking about this historic Grand Slam win. Enjoy your week, enjoy your weekend, and we will see you next week. Bye.